Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday. Every Wednesday, you and I have the opportunity to meet another woman who's walking her path and has agreed to share her experiences with us. Today is no different. I am very pleased to introduce to you Beverly Wilmore. Beverly has over 35 years of experience in media, digital sales, and leadership management. We're going to have to ask her what that means. Beverly, welcome to Mind Talk.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, let's get started at the beginning. I'm going to ask you where you were born and what your early life was like.
Well, I was born in California, a city by the name of Vallejo, California, near San Francisco. And my early years were really the foundation of really how I am today. My parents were sweethearts from high school, and they came from families where there was lots of love. And no matter what was going on in the lives of the family, they always exuded lots of love, which provided myself and my siblings with security. And it allowed us to trust and to also learn how to love back. So I'm one of four children. I'm the second, so therefore I'm the middle child. And I really have always enjoyed my family. I don't know any different.
Well,
so through my walks of life, you know, that's what I give back is love.
Tell me about your early influencers. It sounds like your parents certainly had a significant impact on you. Was there anyone else in addition to your folks?
Besides my family, of course, my mother and my father. My mother was a homemaker early in life, and then my dad was an entrepreneur, and he always had a focus on dreaming big and achieving. And, you know, acknowledging whenever he, you know, achieved something, you know, or whether we achieved something. But also I had some very, very strong grandmothers. And when they sat down to tell the story, you know, it wasn't always a great story. And it always was surprising to me how positive and loving they were, even though they went down some roads that would seemingly make people very hardened or bitter or angry. But that never was something that I ever experienced with them. As I began to get into my, you know, adolescent years and teen years and young adult and embarking on my career, I've always seemingly had to people that were positive in my walks of life. I think back on that now because that's not always the case with people that I talk to in my adult life. But maybe I think it was something that I chose to see was the positive in things. And that's what maybe people gravitated to as I became older in my life. As a child, I was always a leader. I was always instructing people to do something. But it was always something that was fun and that people wanted to do. So here again, reflection on my life now as I was when I was a child, it still is the same as me becoming more of an inspirer and a leader.
What was your plan for yourself as you approached adolescence? Did you have one?
Well, outside of looking at my mom and my grandmothers, I wanted to be a mother. I wanted to be a wife. And I wanted to be successful in whatever I chose to do. And my dad and my mom, they had a business. So entrepreneurship was always something that I aspired. I didn't know what it was going to be in, but I know that I wanted to develop something and to bring others along to be a part of that.
You know, I don't think that we can underscore enough the positive, powerful impact of growing up in a household where your experience was love and acceptance, because so many times that actually doesn't happen.
Exactly. And even with my siblings, there were never any rivalries with my siblings. We protected each other. We loved each other. And we included each other into anything that we did. My mother really gave us a lot of exposure with arts, just giving us an opportunity to experience different things. And if we didn't like it, we just moved on. I know that I took guitar lessons. My sister took flute lessons, and she said that it made her dizzy, so she stopped doing it. And then, but my mother involved us in the arts. I mean, ballet, tumbling and gymnastics and baton twirling, and a lot of our friends were just intrigued by it. Oftentimes they would want to go with us to our classes to watch, because their parents weren't doing that, and this was something that was, I guess, non-traditional for a lot of kids growing up at that time, and especially, you know, African-American children. So we just did it because we looked at it as just something fun. And getting that exposure. Dad was a great golfer. Matter of fact, my mom actually introduced him to golf when they were in high school. My dad just took it on and would always come home with winning every tournament pretty much and bringing home the trophy. And so winning was important to us too. We have that competitive nature about us, but we also, you know, it was healthy competition. And like I said, coming full circle back to my siblings, we loved each other. We were there to protect one another. We didn't know any other way.
Well, you know, that's what I was about to say. It sounds, you know, so many times parents teach their children their fears, and they teach their children, you know, their anxieties and their worries. And it doesn't sound like you had any of that at all. It really sounds like your parents were well prepared and able to see each of you as individuals, which often kind of gets lost when there are more than one child in the family.
Absolutely. And you have to remember, my parents were, when they were younger, my father was ill as a child. And my mom really had a hard time with her first childbirth of my sister. So, you know, they didn't think that they would have, first of all, any children, and they wanted children. And then let alone after the first one, they wanted more. And so, you know, we were really a blessing to them. And they really were grateful to have us, and they shared that with us, that they really enjoyed being parents. And I think that sometimes is, gets lost.
Absolutely.
You know, having fun with your children, but also providing, you know, structure, because that's what they're there for. They're to be the parents. And sometimes we laugh and say, you know, we should spell it P-A-I-R, rent. We're on loan to them, right, while we're here.
Right.
But they're pair, P-A-I-R. So they really enjoyed us.
That's wonderful. It's wonderful to hear about. Tell me what school was like for you growing up.
Well, in my younger years, I had a great time. I mean, I enjoyed my teachers. I was always the teacher's pet. I don't know how that happened.
I don't suppose you worked for that.
You know, because I was engaging. I just wanted to have fun. But my friends were there, and I didn't feel any pressure, and we just had a great time learning. But then as we got older and I got into the junior high school level, that's when I started having issues. My family moved to another city in California, and because of my experience with tumbling and athletics, you know, I beat out some of the kids that were traditionally number one with athletics, and that didn't bode too well. I mean, I remember having enemies, and that was something that was totally out of my comfort zone, you know, at that important time in my life. And it was very devastating to me. And so at the end of the day, though, you know, my parents were always so supportive, and they just were comforting and reassuring, and realized, hey, Beverly, not everyone's going to be your friend. Little did I know that that kind of insight would really chart me as I moved forward to make sure that I was true to myself and that I didn't look for that kind of acknowledgement all the time in my life, because it was not going to exist with some people being right?
And it's really going to weaken.
They were grooming me. Yeah, they were grooming me for the real world, really.
Well, you know, so often children, and certainly girl children, as you well know, are really groomed to be more concerned about others than about themselves, and to be so concerned about how they're seen by others, and that you were taught the opposite of that. You need to feel secure and loved within yourself. Again, a critically important part of your foundation.
Yes, I agree. I agree. And, you know, so at the end of the day, I remember my grandmother telling me when I came home from kindergarten the first day, I brought some friends, maybe like four or five, and said, "These are all my friends." He said, "Grandma, you cannot kidnap these kids. You've got to get them go back to school." But I know that is something that I do still to this day. You know, I have some really good BFFs, and that we're there to encourage one another. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm always looking to figure out how can I help them? How can I include them? How can I bring them along? How do I stay in touch with them? Let them know that I'm thinking about them. And that's in my DNA. It's going to always be there. But, you know, God gives me also clarity and letting me, an instruction to let me know who to stay away from, too. They do not have your best interest at heart, Beverly. Walk away. Walk away.
Which is also a very important skill to have. What were race relations like as you were going into school, junior high school and high school? Did you have any concerns, or were there any difficulties you were aware of?
That's a very good question, because my siblings and I sit down and talk about that now, that very same thing now, and especially now that I've moved to the South, which is the first time I've lived in the South. And my daughter even shares as well that, you know, she never really experienced any distinction between the races in the environment that we grew up in and that she grew up in. My parents made sure that we understood who we were and whose we were, and the dynamics of, you know, learning Swahili. My dad brought a Swahili game home. We had a restaurant which was called the Spear Restaurant, featuring the finest in soul cuisine. So we were always very, you know, very cognizant of our heritage and very proud of it. I know when we growing up, we all wanted to get the afros. My dad was a barber, so, you know, we were excited about that. My mom wouldn't let us have afros because of long ponytails, so we had to, my dad bought us some afro wigs that we walked around with and proudly of who we were, and we wore our African garbs for, you know, certain events that we were a part of. So, but my dad said to me, and I never will forget it, he says, you know, I always wanted my children to have what everyone else had. And I know that what he meant was, you know, since he golfed a lot, you know, when he was with a lot of white folks, that there were, you know, at certain levels. And he didn't feel that because we were African American that we should not have those things. It was, we should have everything, even more, you know, because we work hard, we're good people, and, you know, we want to make a difference in the world. And that's what's my dad, and that was my mom. And so I never really felt that. Now, maybe my younger siblings did when they were growing up, but certainly my sister, my older sister and I, we never even discussed that around the table. We just, it was assumption that we knew who we were and our culture and African-American and being African-American, and we were proud of that. And I always was drawn to African-American legends. When I grew up, my book reports were always about, well, Althea Gibson, Martin Luther King Jr., Shirley Chisholm. I mean, so that's what I saw, you know, and even getting into this business of communications, you know, I would always gravitate to the African-Americans that were news anchors. And that's what intrigued me to get into the field that I'm in today.
You talk about being aware as a young one of your history. Do you believe that that history is taught or valued as much today as it needs to be from your perspective?
Well, I think it depends on where you live in the country.
Okay.
Having grown up in Northern California, and then going to school in Washington, D.C., and then now living in the South, they're very different experiences that's going on. And my parents were from the South. I mean, my dad was born in Vicksburg, Mississippi, and my mom was born in West Virginia, but they migrated to California at such an early age. But I'm just thinking about, even when I think about my grandparents and how I sit down and we had conversations with them, they would always share words of wisdom, but it was never anything specific about what they experienced in terms of racism.
Okay.
But we knew that it existed. But today, listening to my daughter, who's just turned 27, and now she's living here in the South, she shared with me some insight that she observed. She never really felt, because she's a beautiful brown-skinned young lady, and she never felt comfortable in her skin because people would say negative things about her. And so now she says here in the South, she feels more appreciated as she dates, that her skin color is more widely accepted. Isn't that interesting?
It really is. It really is.
It hurt my heart, though, that she felt bad about who she was, because she was always in an environment where there was encouragement, you know, with family. But, you know, the world is cold and cruel sometimes.
It can be.
And that's the reality of it. So.
And one of the things that parents often lose sight of is how powerful what's going on outside of the home is in a child's life. And a lot of times the children don't share it. So the parent has no way to, they have no way to counteract it. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's what I try to do, is to provide an environment where we can have an openness and talk about things that, you know, are great, of course, but they're also the reality of things too that are not so great, and to be vulnerable and feel protected as you share your inner thoughts. And so it was kind of hurtful for me to hear that from her. The other dynamic, as we grow up, my nieces, we have all colors in our family, you know, mm-hmm. blended families and everything. So I'm cognizant as to learning from them their experiences today, you know, as being a young adult, and how they're perceived and what their feelings are in terms of racism.
Well,
that occurs here now.
It's so interesting that we live in a world where not only are you accepted or rejected by many people, not all, based on your physical appearance. Are you short? Are you tall? Are you thin? Are you not? But also on the shade of the color of your skin. It really is kind of amazing.
I did not realize that. Here again, maybe I was a little bit naive or protected, overprotected. I don't know, my parents, I think they did a great job. But, you know, when I went into Howard University's campus, I didn't even know what the brown paper bag test was. I'm like, what are you guys talking about? We're all here, and I'm so excited, and, you know, about being a part of history and on this campus. And that came up, you know. But, at the end of the day, I start looking at some of these things are just going to happen. I can't control it.
That's
but
true.
What I can do is choose how I respond to it.
Beverly,
and a lot of the times I push it back to them. That's their issue, not mine. I'm moving on.
There you go. Beverly Wilmore, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'd like to hear more from you about your experience at a historically Black university, Howard University in Washington, D.C. Beverly, talk about the brown paper bag test. You mentioned that just before the break. What is that? What was that?
Yes. Yeah, so when we're talking about, first of all, I was so excited to be accepted to Howard University. My mother was supposed to go to Howard University, but she fell in love with my dad. And so she ended up staying in California. So I kind of stepped up and did that for her. And in turn, learned so much about myself. So we'll always be grateful. But I get on the campus, and I'm seeing all the African-American folks on campus and teachers and students. And I am just in awe because I've never experienced all this before. And people that I've read about, it's just awesome. So when they start talking about the yard and how you had the fraternities and the sororities, they're on the yard and they're stepping and they're doing their thing. I didn't know what that was, and it was exciting. But then I start learning more about each one of the fraternities and the sororities, and especially the DSTs, the Delta Sigma Thetas and the AKAs. I start reading the history about it and how the Delta Sigma Thetas were browner than the brown paper bag. And then the AKAs traditionally were lighter than the brown paper bag. And that was the determining or distinction is whether you would be able to be a part of their sororities. And like, what in the world is that? That makes absolutely no sense. Now, of course, that's not the case anymore. But just to learn what that meant was just really heartbreaking to me. But, you know, it was what it was, you know, and you just move on now. And that's the experience that I had. But I will never, ever forget my experience on Howard University's campus because it really championed me to be even more courageous and confident. I mean, just to see the energy and the knowledge that was just there on campus. I still stay in touch with a lot of my friends and schoolmates from college, and so incredibly proud of them and how they continue to move forward. And I think that the format that they had there at School Communications, where I graduated from, continues to be blazing ahead in innovation and technology and championing a lot of graduates to move on in the industry. I mean, I'm very proud to say that I am in the industry that I studied for at Howard University.
And a lot of people don't have that experience. Is there a continuing need, do you think, for historically black colleges to exist, or is that no longer important in today's world?
I think that it is incredibly important for us to continue to have and support and have our children attend the historical black colleges. There's some work that needs to be done, and I think that we should make sure that we take care of the experience that we provide for our students and ensuring that they continue to strive for and be successful and pull others along with them. But we've got to button up our admin, our administration buildings, and making sure that we have the right curriculums and the connections with the corporations to be able to support our infrastructures in our historical black colleges, and also have the jobs waiting for our students when they graduate, and be committed to hiring them and career pathing them for excellence.
You talked about with appreciation about your experience at the School of Communications. What is or was the School of Communications? What kind of communications did you study? What was so positive about the curriculum?
Okay. So I majored in broadcast management and I minored in business. And I'll never will forget that there was at the time not a minor in business. It was political science as a minor, or I think journalism. It was one of the two. Having had worked at a TV station in California before going to Howard University, I knew I wanted to get into the business aspect of the broadcast industry because at the time, cable was just a wire that was strung to some of those remote areas that give people ability to watch television. So, you know, really wasn't really focusing on cable television as much as broadcast. And so I remember having to go to my counselor and saying that I really wanted to have my minor to be a brought to be a business minor, and I really had to take more credit hours in order for them to agree to that. So I remember one time I took 24 credit hours my senior year right before I graduated because I had to take all these business classes. But I will tell you, I did it. And I'm so glad that I did. They'll understand that there's business minors and entrepreneurial class minors to the majors of the School of Communication. So I like to think I had something to do with that. But what I loved about it was when I walked on that campus, we had just opened up Channel 32. And we had a beautiful facility. And I got an opportunity to work with a gentleman by the name of Jim Brown, who is still my mentor today. And he brought me in, and he would share with me his wisdom. He included me in on a lot of the employee meetings. So I really felt that he was there to champion and support my success. He made sure that I was visible with a variety of organizations that were out there. It was just a great, exciting time for me to be a part of the School of Communications at that time. We were just evolving even more so. They had the two radio stations, WHUR and the AM station, and it was just a wonderful time. I just love the fact that the people that were in that School of Communications, they were connected, and they really would support anyone, at least my perspective, that showed an interest in really learning the business and being able to just soak in what the industry was bearing at that time. You never will forget it.
You majored in broadcast management. For those listening who don't really know what that means when it comes to the media, what exactly does that mean?
Okay, great. So initially, when we think about broadcasting, especially at that time, you think about the on-air personalities. People that we see on television. But there's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes that make that broadcast station the way that it is. And that is having a general manager, someone who's overseeing the operations, whether it's accounting or sales or finance as well. You need to have someone to oversee and run that station. And that's what my interest was, is to be in the leadership position, overseeing various departments, making sure that revenue was coming in, great programming was going out. And so that's what broadcast management was all about. And that's why I majored in it.
And would you say that broadcast management today has similar requirements and opportunities in terms of tasks?
It does, but, you know, it went from management, meaning managing things, to leadership, which is leading a team, and now we're moving and evolving into influencing, making sure that you are in tune to what your teams need, and then being an influencer to maneuver through to get the job done. But making sure that the teams that you're influencing can see the benefit, and they see that they're resourceful back, not just being dictated to, you know, top level down, but, you know, bottom level up, making sure that they know that they have resources and suggestions to continue to grow. And that's where you see your Googles and your Yahoos of the world. They provide those infrastructures now to make sure that they have many entrepreneurs. When I say many, I'm not talking about M-A-N-Y. I'm talking about M-I-N-I, many entrepreneurs that are running around that can give contributions back. Because at the end of the day, we're really looking at what consumer behavior is all about and what their needs are. The consumers are in the driver's seat now of where the technology goes.
And that's interesting because I'm not clear that consumers often experience themselves as being in the driver's seat.
They don't, you know, but they are. And I'm not talking about with an automobile, literally. I'm talking about, you know, what they're... As we collect more data that shares with us what consumers are doing and what's important to them, then we back into creating the technology or modifying the technology to be able to provide the consumers with what they're needing. And you're right, they don't often know what they need. We just have to look at the data. The data will tell us what it is that they want and what they need. We're in a different stage in our life now. It's really quite interesting.
It is, and I just think it's so important to remind folks that as the consumers of media, their power is great.
It is so great. I mean, they have more power than I think they realize, as you mentioned a little bit earlier. But with that power, there's responsibility. And that's what I'm thinking, because it just has a big reflect on our world today. We've got to be respectful of our power, knowledgeable of it, but respectful of it, and know that what we do affects a generation and affects the world. And so I think that it's important to look at the data, okay, but to also have discernment on what we should do with that data once we receive it and send it back to the world. The kids today, with the exposure that they have with the multiple devices, you know, get some information quick and it's unfiltered. So it allows them to be able to craft from their beliefs and their experiences how they disseminate that information back out. And that's powerful, but it also can be dangerous.
Absolutely.
If it's in the wrong hands.
Absolutely. It's good news and bad news.
Yes.
When you started your training in broadcast management at Howard University in Washington, D.C., were there many women in your courses?
There were women, a lot of women in my classes. From all over, actually. A lot of them wanted to be in production, you know, and produce their programs, which I thought was really exciting because will give the women the voices, right, out there. But in terms of my instructors, maybe a couple were instructors at that time.
Interesting.
But we did have quite a few women that were in my classes, which is great.
Talk about your first job after graduating from Howard University.
After I graduated from Howard University, I actually accepted a position at KSTS TV 48, which was an independent television station in my hometown, San Jose, California. And that particular owner, his name is John Douglas. He is still my mentor today as well. He actually graduated from Howard University, now that I think about it, and that's how we connected. I saw him written up in an article at Ebony Magazine and told him that when I come home for the holidays, I'd like to have lunch. And he said, yes. So he hired me right out of school, and of course, because I thought I had my degree, that I would just move right into a sales position. He was very nice at reminding me, no, Beverly, you've got to go through, you'll be a receptionist. You will answer the phones for us. And, you know, and then, you know, we would check in. So I start doing work for him. And at the end of the day, he said, okay, Bev, you've been here for a year now. Now you've got to find your replacement and I'll move you into sales. But, you know, it was a great exposure for me because I got a chance at such a small station to learn so many things from management and leadership from my mentor, who was the owner of KSTS TV 48, but also integrate myself with all the various departments as well, learn what they were responsible for. And then from there, I backed into the sales. Sales has always been intriguing to me because I got a chance to interface with the advertising community and help a business to grow, you know, and I had that entrepreneurial independence as well. So that was a great great story with my first job because my boss at the time really made me feel like he needed my resources just as much as I needed his.
That, one of the wonderful things about working with a small entity, as you said, is that you really get exposed to all of the business, whether it's an area that you think that you are particularly interested in or not. You get an important educational exposure.
Absolutely. And it's so funny, as I start charting my career, I see that I've always migrated to smaller companies. I've always said, even to today, I said it would be so neat just to be sitting in your office and then you just push your chair back and you look at the president and CEO and say, I have an idea. Let's meet for lunch. You know, I love that. But, you know, every time I work with a company, it seems like it's always bought out and it becomes this big, big conglomeration. And so, you know, and then you get lost, right, and become a number. And I always want to make sure that I matter, because I always want to make sure that I, what I have to say is considered. And so that's fulfilling to me when I'm working for a company, is that I'm in a position where I can contribute as well as continue to learn. You know, be the student one day and the teacher the next day, and not get lost in all the layers.
And it is so easy, particularly nowadays, as people are buying up, seems like, almost everything every day. It is easy to get lost. Let me ask you this. Your first job, now you've graduated from Howard University, you've got your degree, you're ready to run a department, you think, and
yes.
And instead you are offered a job as a receptionist. Now, I dare say that you and I both know people who will, with degree in hand or even almost degree in hand, will think that they should get a management position or at least something that's more in line with what they're studying. You did not study to be a receptionist. Talk about the value of that, of accepting that position, and why it's important.
Yes, you know, coming from a family where, you know, of entrepreneurs, it was just, you assume that you're just going to move right into becoming an entrepreneur. But you're not going to be a successful one unless you, you know, do the due diligence and the homework to learn more about what it is that your craft is and what you can contribute to. And so, you know, receptionist is okay, because I got a chance to, like I said, greet people when they came in. They wouldn't have known me if I was sitting back around the corner, you know. So I got a chance to learn more about who our guests were. I made sure that I interfaced, like I said, with all the different departments. The title at the time, although I thought it was important, I look back on it, it was not as important. I look at the job description and the title of the position, but then I look at the additional projects that I was given based on my accountability to the job that I accepted. So in other words, I accepted this job, I did the job that they asked me to do, and they hired me to do, but then they realized the talent in me, and they gave me more responsibility. So I took that position, and I grew it into something that didn't exist. It was based on the need and my competencies. And that's what I try and share with my teens today, mm-hmm. you know, as I begin to lead them, is, you know, I look at, this is what you signed up for, which is the job description, but this is what you're doing, and I acknowledge them based on what they share with me that they can do over and above, and they love that because it's growing them. It's my commitment into them, growing them in their career, and so I give them special little projects that they can receive fulfillment on as well, and I make sure they add that to their resumes. I acknowledge that to them in their performance reviews because, you know, we look at what's needed in our department or what's in our company or our infrastructure, and we champion ourselves to accomplish that goal. And then you have to recognize and acknowledge. I think that's so important.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about a receptionist I met who mm-hmm. worked for a media company and was so insulted that was her job and her title, that she actually became known for her bad behavior rather than good behavior or talents. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Beverly Wilmore. Don't go away. Beverly, I want to fast forward to what you're doing today. One of the things that you do as I look at your resume is you are a multi-screen strategist. Please help me understand what that is.
Yes, so as we continue to evolve in our media and telecommunications industry, what we're learning there, the consumers are really using multiple screens. They're using the traditional television screen, but they also are using their laptop, and they're using their desktop and their tablet and also their smartphones to gather information and to also share information. So this is an entity, an extension of traditional media, where companies are looking at, and especially cable companies, are looking at, you know, how do I continue to put forth the messaging to the consumers? Where are they going to get their information? And we better go there, too. So there's a digital department that I have that I run in the Southeast division. And it's really designed to offer our advertisers an opportunity to speak to the consumers on all of the screens, not just a traditional television screen.
So do you need to understand the mechanics, if you will, of the visual images, how they differ across screens?
Right. So when you're looking at digital advertising, you're looking at banner ads. There are a variety of them, but display ads. So if you're on your mobile or on your desktop or your laptop, you'll search for content information that's important to you as a consumer, and you'll see advertisement banners that are located on the top or the sides of that particular device. And those banners are interactive. So if I am, as a consumer, looking and researching for information that's important to me, and I see a banner ad that's relevant to what I'm interested in, I'm going to probably scroll over and click on that banner ad and then take a look at that particular business's website. And then that website then can drive me to search more about that information or go into their brick and mortar or order something online. So it allows that consumer to participate, interact, and learn more about that business or, you know, electronically go into the brick and mortar of a business, if you will. So that is a huge, huge revenue stream. And like I said, as you start working with more millennials, you see that it's important for them to get their information quick, when they want it and how they want it. And so if you want to continue to thrive in this industry and thrive as a business, you better have a website and a landing page and be able to speak to people on all the devices. And we're starting to see a little bit of erosion with television viewing, newspaper. They knew that they had to step into that industry if they wanted to continue to command the advertising dollars from their clients. Same thing with broadcast stations, like I said, and radio stations. They now all have their own home pages and their websites because that's how people are interacting now. And so I'm really excited to be able to represent that segment of the industry. Who would have thought when I was at Howard University majoring in broadcast that we would even talk about cable, let alone now looking at all of the divestitures and integrations of different businesses coming together in a collaborative effort to offer this exciting technology to consumers. It's just the most amazing thing.
As I listen to you describe what some of your work product is like, I'm wondering if you can share with listeners the kind of skills you possess that allow you to function in this position and, quite frankly, function so very well. What do they need to know?
Well, I want to first talk about the fact that I have two words that I don't like to use. They're not in my vocabulary, and they are can't and impossible. So, first of all, you have to have a can-do attitude and know that most things are possible. You know, you just have to have a positive mental attitude. You have to have a quest for knowledge. You have to get up every day excited about what you're going to discover or offer today, you know, and do that every single day. Your commitment to develop relationships and resources. I mean, these are things that are beyond what you learn in the classroom. I mean, the classroom, I think, is great. Gives you that entry to it. You can Google whatever you need to know now. But having that drive within yourself to understand what your greatness is. And, of course, you know, I authored my book, Motivating Greatness. And I really sometimes have to go back and make sure that I'm being true to myself and have self-healing through my book, because sometimes things may not go the way you want them to go, but they're still going forward. So, and, you know, speaking my truth, sharing my vulnerabilities, and looking at what it is that I want to accomplish, beginning, I almost say, with the end in mind, and how do I get there, what journey, developing the board members of your life so that those mentors that I talk to you about, I still stay in touch with them today. I still get insight from them. And then just reading up on the industry and where it is now, and being inquisitive and curious on where it's going, developing those relationships, and not, here's another thing, being courageous. Oftentimes we think, I think sometimes people say, oh, well, I could never do that, or that's because they are like that, that they got that. You deserve to have the best in life. And all you have to do is pick up the phone or send over an email to someone that's in the business. Most of the time, they will extend back out to you. So not be fearful of that. And sometimes you may have to work without pay. Sometimes you may need to volunteer to get that experience and that exposure.
But it sounds like you're saying.
I'm sorry.
Even in the volunteering, it sounds like you're saying that that is incredibly valuable.
It is so valuable. And as you get through your life, you realize what's most important. You know, oftentimes your priorities may be to make the money. Then you get to a certain level when you made that money, and you go, okay, well, I need to have fulfillment. Am I giving back? Am I still growing, or did I become complacent? You know, and I felt sorry for that young lady that you were talking about a little bit earlier, who was a receptionist, and she was mad.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? She was mean, you know, and we don't want that to happen, because, you know, we want to be open to the experience at that point in time of our journey. And so I say, if you get up every morning and you're mad and you're mean, find out, you know, release yourself from that. And I've had to do that with some of my employees. I felt that they had come to the end of their journey within their career path with me. And I had to help them see that their life is beautiful, but they had come to their end of their journey. So let me release you to go find happiness. And I've done that. They've come back to me in the years, you know, that would pass and say, thank you so much for coaching me and helping me to see that. And they are happier in their lives.
You use the term coaching. Do you see that as part of your job, your mission?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's what's one of the things that's so fulfilling to me, is that when I do have the opportunity, whether it's on the job or in my community outreach that I do, or even, you know, speaking engagements or book signings, people are so thirsty and so hungry for good leaders, authentic leaders, people reassuring them that they matter, encouraging them to take that step forward and to understand their greatness and their potential. That is so fulfilling to me, to have people say, you know, Beverly, you said this to me 5 years ago, and have that resonate and motivate them to do, be, and have of themselves. It's just so important. Oftentimes, you know, you have, like I said, managers that manage things, but the leaders are the ones that really help people to champion to be the best of who they are. Because once you do that, then people feel like they can contribute. They're less frightened and fearful, and in the company will thrive from what their employees are able to offer. They have more creativity. That will exude as a result of reducing fear. And, and communication is so important. Communication styles. Oh, my goodness, in my early days in leadership, you know, I just thought that everyone would think and receive things like I did. Wouldn't that be easy? But I had to
not so much.
That everyone is divine individuals. And I had to stop talking and start listening. and watching the body language and asking those important open-end questions and not making assumptions, but learning from them.
So very often communications is about listening. You're right.
Absolutely. I have in my book, as my dad said, that we're born with two eyes and two ears and one mouth.
So listen. talk
so
about.
So in other words, observe, listen, and talk less.
It can be quite useful. Talk about motivating greatness.
Well, that was a book that evolved as a result of a show that I had. It was a web-based talk show, and it was called Motivate. And it was really a show that was designed to bring people in and talk a little bit about their greatness and what motivated them to be who they were today, And so from that show, I was watching how people were, some of my guests were just evolving right before my eyes. There were some questions I would ask them, and then what would happen is that they would have self-discovery. They would start talking, and their eyes were getting bigger, and they're looking at me like, oh, my gosh, I didn't even know this was inside of me. So I'm like, okay, Beverly, that's something that just doesn't happen. There's a reason why this is all happening here. So I thought once the show ended, it ran for about 15 weeks, and I said, ended with Danny Glover. It was so much fun. I think it was supposed to be just 20 minutes, but with Danny, he was talking 45 minutes. He was having some great time. So I let him go ahead, let the camera still roll. But at the end of the day, I ended up wanting to continue with that journey. And that's when I wrote the book, Motivating Greatness. And it really was just talking about how people really are, I want them to continue to embrace their life, to really understand what a remarkable gift that everyone has is greatness, and that it should not be kept inside, that you should look forward to seeing the greatness every day, journal your experience, because, one day you may have be experiencing a certain type of greatness, and it's a great day, it's positive and affirming. And then there are some times, as my sister, older sister knows, when you're having a not-so-great day, and I remember calling her one day saying, I'm having such a great day. And she says, well, there's this author that I know, and she's wrote this book called Motivating Greatness. And she said, there's tip number, because my book has, various tips that you can look at each day to make sure you're accountable to your greatness and to share it with others. And so she said, there's tip number 25 that said, keep your chin up. And it gives you those words and then affirmation, and then you're supposed to journal in it. And I said, thank you very much. So I went back to my own book for healing. Because as you go through life, sometimes you forget some of these things, right?
That is
so
very true.
So I often will read my book to get myself, self-healing as well. But, things do happen. And I do think that this book does help a lot of people. I get emails or calls from individuals that have used my book or purchased some for it. More than likely, they'll look at the book and they go, this is a great book. Oh, my gosh, I can relate to this. And they'll say, I have three other friends that can relate to this, too. And they'll get, four books instead of just that one. And so I'm hoping that it is helping people to have more fulfillment in their lives and not be so downtrodden on things that you cannot really change, but what are you going to do within your moments of life that could be fulfilling to you and to help other people? So that's what this book was designed to do. And I'm working on my other ones as well, because I still have more inside to share.
Well, the next one that comes out, I'm expecting you to come back on Mind Talk and tell us about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's almost finished.
Okay.
It's like birthing a baby.
Indeed it
but,
is.
What happens is I go through life and I get more material because I've talked to some people that were interested in publishing a book and writing a book. Well, how do you get started? I said, just keep living.
keep living. We'll
just
do it
keep
a lot.
Living. That's right.
How do folks find out, more about you or more about your book?
Well, you can go right to my website. It's so easy. It's BeverlyWilmore.com.
And
my first and last name.com.
Can you spell that for me?
BEVERLY WILMORE.com.
And that's where you'll get all the information you need.
That's right.
Beverly, as we close out today, I'm wondering if there is a final word of, what can I say, encouragement that you would like to offer folks listening who are still trying to find their way in their professional worlds or are in a place where they've been for a long time. They want to get out, but they don't know how. I realize that's two very different populations, but I think you can handle it.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, here it is. You've got to start from yourself. You know, I always ask God to provide me with clarity on what he has for me to do in terms of his instruction for my purpose in life. And I think if you can stand grounded in that and be prepared to receive, you know, his insight and his instruction, no matter what people will say or you think they may be thinking, you know, just know that what you're doing is purposeful because God has blessed you with greatness. And there will be someone that will be able to receive. You have to believe that, receive what you have to offer. And I always say, I want what God wants, because when I look back on my life, there are so many things that happen, and it's like, how did that happen? What did I do? But, you know, if I can just be focused on what God wants for me to do and have faith in that, you know, and look at every opportunity as being just that. It's not the end all. It's a stepping stone to your greatness. So learn all that you're supposed to learn where you are now, and then take that and make it great for you for the next step. And have, my word for this year is patience. Have patience. Don't move too swiftly because you may miss it, you know, but slow it down a little bit. Use those two eyes and those two ears. Ask important questions that are open-ended so that you can learn. And love yourself and love your days that you have, because tomorrow is not promised. So do what you're instructed to do and enjoy it.
You have been
Those
listening.
Those are my final thoughts.
Thank you very much. You have been listening to Beverly Wilmore. And again, her website is beverlywilmore.com. Beverly, again, thank you so much for joining us today here on Mind Talk.
Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today here on Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. You can listen to Mind Talk on demand by going to mindtalk.org. And again, that's mindtalk.org. Or you can go to the iTunes Store for the Mind Talk app or the Google Play Store for the Mind Talk app. Folks, I want you to always remember, if it's unacceptable, well, then that's exactly what it is. You take care.